This meeting actually had one organizer and two disorganizers. So despite the efforts of Boris and I, Masoud did a great job getting everyone here. I'd like to thank him very much. For every six emails he sent us, we maybe replied to one. But nonetheless, you all managed to get the message and get here. This is an introductory talk covering material which I've talked about before in many places, so my friends will have heard this lecture before. It's like a rerun. Oh, this does not amplify, it just records. Is that right?
Yeah, it's on, right?
All right. Testing, testing. Does that sound good? You can all hear me now? Yep. Good? All right. So I want to describe this local index formula of Kanon-Moscovici. It's a funny thing. And I'll spend almost the whole lecture talking about background, and then just at the very end, the formula in all of its grotesque complexity will be revealed to you. Let me give you a little indication of where we're going. Suppose you have an elliptic operator on a manifold, just on a compact manifold. As is almost always the case in index theory, we'll imagine that it's decomposed according to some grading. So it actually looks like this, where D minus is the adjoint of D plus. Then it's an old observation of Bott and Atiyah that the index of D, perhaps I should say the index of D plus, can be computed by means of a kind of a crazy formula. Namely, you take the residue at S is equal to zero, the gamma function times the trace of epsilon, which is, throughout this talk, epsilon will be this operator, the grading operator, epsilon times, well, something like 1 plus D squared. Minus S, that would do the job. That's due to Atiyah and Bott. As we'll see, this is a hopeful beginning for index theory because despite its appearances, the right-hand side of this formula has a computational aspect which the left-hand side doesn't have. Anyway, of course, then there's the famous Atiyah-Singer index theorem. Let's just state it, say, for the Dirac operator. So this is the integral over M of some explicit quantity. Now, what emerges is that this funny residue is actually the integral of some function on the manifold M. So there's a sense in which this first formula is a local formula. It breaks up the index, which is an integer, into a quantity which is distributed over the whole manifold, and then you integrate it up, and then you get the index. And then it's a kind of a miracle that that quantity turns out to be something from differential topology, the Aruf form. So this is the index theorem. Now, the theorem of Kanon-Moscovici attempts to generalize this set of ideas in the direction of non-commutative geometry, and where it ends up is somewhere approximately in the middle of these two things. So what emerges from this work of Kanon-Moscovici is a formula which is more sophisticated and a little more substantial than this observation of Atiyah and Bott, which is actually something very elementary in spectral theory. On the other hand, it's not the same as saying that the index is equal to the Aruf genus of a manifold. The formula of Kanon-Moscovici, so to speak, takes this observation of Atiyah and Bott and promotes it to a much more sophisticated statement at the level of cyclic cohomology. So you're identifying not numbers anymore on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, but cyclic co-cycles. But nonetheless, it doesn't go as far as actually determining what the index is in the case that's perhaps of the most practical interest, namely the case of a Dirac operator on a manifold. So it's a kind of a funny theorem. It sits in a place which doesn't really exist in the classical world. between this very simple spectral theoretic formula, as it turns out, and this explicit computation, of course, due to a Tyrian Singer. So, that's where we're going. That doesn't... How does this... yeah, does it raise, or is it just... I just give it a little more heft. Okay. I didn't want to break it. Now, the major problem that one confronts in looking at this formula in a more general context is to try and figure out what does local mean. It's pretty clear what local means in the context of the classical index theorem. This integer, as I said, should be distributed across the entire manifold, so you can make a statement just depending on the local geometry of the manifold. But what does this mean in some situation where there is no local? For example, in non-commutative geometry. So in non-commutative geometry, you have some, instead of having a manifold M, you have some algebra A, which you're supposed to think of as functions on M. But of course, as everyone knows, it can be non-commutative when one considers much more elaborate examples. So there's kind of an issue here. Local means point-wise, but a point is the same thing as a homomorphism from the algebra of functions, the coordinate functions, to the scalars, and you take coordinates and you evaluate them at points. So there's a real problem if, for example, your algebra is simple and doesn't have any ideals, then it's not clear at all where you should be heading when one wants to just come up with an analog of this. So in particular, there's no localization in the usual sense of geometry. There are no ideals in the sort of typical sort of algebras that Kahn is looking at. So what do you do? So the answer to that, the answer that Kahn and Moscovici are currently promoting, has to do with spectral theory, and in particular the famous theorem of Hermann Weyl. So this was one of the all-time great moments in Hilbert space theory when Hermann Weyl proved this result. Suppose you have a manifold or a domain, let's call it M. So Weyl was just considering bounded domains in the plane. Then the physicists were very interested, of course, in studying the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator on this manifold, on this domain, with say, Dirichlet boundary conditions, if it has a boundary. And Lorentz made a conjecture about this asymptotic function here, the number of eigenvalues less than a given lambda. We made a conjecture, and it was felt that this nobody in their lifetime would see the resolution of this conjecture. But then the very next year, Hermann Weyl proved this, and as he said in a later lecture, this was very encouraging for him. So and what he showed is this famous asymptotic formula. That, well, let's just consider the... I don't have to sweat the constants here. Let's just consider a two-dimensional manifold or domain. This quotient here is just the area of M up to some constant, which happens to be 4 pi in this particular case. Lorentz, who discovered the electron, made it maybe in 1910, and then in 1911, Hermann Weyl
solved it. And as you know, probably, it's a beautiful and short proof. There exists a beautiful and short proof. There are also beautiful and very long proofs as well. Okay.
So let me just jump ahead a little bit, 50 years or so, and move into the realm of operator algebras. Let me define a collection of operators L. These are operators on the Hilbert space, but compact operators on a Hilbert space. So a compact operator on a Hilbert space has a singular value sequence, which if the operator is positive, is just its eigenvalue sequence. It's a sequence of numbers going to zero, which gives you some indication of how compact the operator is. And they're always called mu's. And the condition I want is that the jth one of these fellows, let's call it something else. Kth one of these fellows is big O of 1 over k. So for every compact operator, the eigenvalue sequence is a sequence of numbers, or the singular value sequence is a sequence of numbers converging to zero. Here are the operators whose eigenvalues, singular values, converge to zero at this particular rate. So they're not quite necessarily in the trace class, because, of course, you can't sum 1 over k. On the other hand, they're more than just compact operators. So here's a little lemma which was observed by Dixmier concerning this ideal. So if I have a positive operator in this collection, what Dixmier did was he formed what would be the trace of the operator, and he just added up these fellows. Of course, they don't add up, because this, in a typical case, this is a harmonic series. So he computed the coefficient of logarithmic divergence like this. And then he took a limit. Which, of course, may or may not exist, but if it doesn't exist, there is some generalized limit which will do the trick. Let's not worry about that. And let's call this whole thing this sort of quantum integral sign of t. So that's the definition. Another lemma, which is not too difficult to prove, is that this extends to a trace on this fellow here, which is actually an ideal inside the bounded operators. And the reason I mention this is that it gives us the opportunity to reformulate Weyl's theorem in some fancier language, as follows. A small, slightly modest generalization of Weyl's theorem. Suppose you have a function on M. Which is, you know, reasonable, measurable, or something bounded. Suppose we take this quantum integral of f times the inverse of the Laplace operator. So the jth eigenvalue, according to this formula of Weyl, the jth eigenvalue of the Laplace operator is approximately j, a constant times j. In fact, it's 4 pi over the area times j, asymptotically. Okay, so take that operator, which lies in the ideal L, and multiply it by f, the pointwise multiplication operator. This thing now is in L. This is not f of the inverse, it's the operator f times the inverse. Okay, and what you get is just the integral of f. And maybe just as a little prelude to what's coming, let me also give you another way of looking at these quantities. So by a Tiberian theorem, this quantity, so all I'm doing here is picking off the constant, which is this limit here. Well, I guess I need to multiply something by 4 pi. So, example, where is it? 1 over 4 pi here. And then the same thing down here. Okay, another way of looking at this is this is the limit as s decreases to 0, excuse me, as s decreases to 1 of s minus 1 times the trace of f times delta to 1 minus s, minus 1 minus s. This is another formula for the same thing. So this little adventure over 50 years or so of analysis is supposed to indicate to you that you can recover integrals, the sort of integrals that appear here, by means of spectral theory, thanks to the theorem of Hermann Weyl and some minor elaborations of it. Okay, and thanks to a Tiberian theorem, it's possible, if you like, and we will actually do this, to consider these integrals, these so-called Dixmier traces, as this is called, as objects which look rather like residues. So when we attempt to carry over this idea of locality to more elaborate algebras and to non-commutative geometry, what we're going to do is approach localization in a space through the large-scale behavior of our operators in the dual space, in phase space. So we're going to be looking at the large-scale spectral behavior of operators associated to a space and hope that that's saying something about the small-scale structure of a space. So we're looking at the local behavior of spaces through this particular funny looking glass. And let me round out this discussion with, in fact, I might just even show you how this is proved, with an important theorem. Also in around about the 50s of Meenakshi Sundaram Plajan. Suppose delta is like the Laplace operator is elliptic, an elliptic operator on a manifold. And just to keep the things a little bit simple, let's just assume it's invertible, not like the Laplace operator. So maybe you take the Laplace operator and add 1 to it. Then the following thing is true. Convenient to throw in another operator here. For any other differential operator D, the function you get by taking the trace of powers of this, so to speak, Laplacian, this thing here, which appears, of course, up here, is in fact a meromorphic function. So this is, this Tiberian result here is a clue, and here's the actual theorem that this is it's meromorphic everywhere. And not that relevant to us, but in fact it has simple poles only. Now, one of Kahn's insights is that this theorem is very important, and this theorem is telling you that underneath this operator there is a real differentiable manifold. So when Kahn looks at an algebra like this one here, and he wants to, of course, there are algebras, and then there are algebras, and some algebras are better than others, and some are supposed to represent non-commutative manifolds, and some aren't. And one of the key features he's looking for when he's trying to find manifold nature in non-commutative algebras is an analog of this theorem here. So I just want to explain to you why this theorem has a lot to do with the manifold nature of manifolds, and maybe pose a little problem, which I don't know how to solve. we're going to spend, after we get through this little proof here, we're going to spend the rest of the hour worrying about manifolds, commutative or non-commutative, through this theorem. So I'd like you to understand that this theorem is very closely connected to the heart of the matter, to coordinates on manifolds and so on. Yeah, I'm willing to give up simple poles. Yeah, that's why I put it in parentheses. Yeah. But the theorem is correct, as I've stated it there. Yeah. So this theorem really does just hinge on manifolds being manifolds, having coordinates. It's based on... This proof is basically due to Gilman, thank you. Basically due to Gilman. And it's based on this Heisenberg relation in the Weyl algebra. Thanks to this relation, if D is a differential operator of order, say, Q, then here's a little formula. Suppose you take D and you commute it with the coordinate function xi. So let's just suppose for simplicity that we're working in a system of local coordinates. So if you had a ddxi in your expression for D, of course it would disappear and get replaced by 1. If you had a ddxj in your expression for G, nothing would happen. The commutator would be 0. Okay. Now, if you look at this expression here, this would take out a ddxi and this would put it back. Okay. And if, so if you did this for every I, what you'd have is the operator you first thought of, except if you had a higher order derivative, for example, ddx times ddx1 times ddx2, you would have put it back twice according to this formula. That's the reason there's a q here. The formula is not exact because if you have a non-constant coefficient operator, the what I just said screwed up a little bit. So there's an error term, r. The order of r is less than the order of d, which is q. All right, so now a little bit of algebra based on the two formulas which are on that board up there. So just by fiddling around, let me get the signs right, just in case, in the remote possibility that someone's actually copying this down. Fiddling around a little bit with algebra, you get this identity here. Actually, having written it down so carefully, I'm going to tell you immediately that I don't really care what it says. What it says is that there are a bunch of commutators plus r, the same remainder r from up above. So, if you had a trace on the algebra of differential operators, the trace of d would be up to this factor of m plus q would be the same thing as the trace of r. So, to compute traces on order q operators, you only need to know traces on order q minus 1 operators, okay, and so on and so forth. So, you see, for example, that there are no traces on the differential operators. Okay, but now let's do something a little bit different. Namely, let's replace D by, the sort of thing which appears here. So let's just say that this expression has order, well, Q for this fellow. And then minus RS, where R is the order of delta. It's a little more difficult to do this computation when you're dealing with these operators here, which are, for example, these complex powers are defined by spectral theory. Nonetheless, the exact same conclusion holds, namely that n, or the order, n, which is the dimension of the manifold, plus the order of whatever it is we're looking at, is a sum of commutators plus a remainder, and the remainder has order one less than the thing you started with. Now, according to Val's theorem, or much more elementary estimates, as long as S is sufficiently big, where's the theorem here? As long as S is sufficiently big, this function is not only meromorphic, but it's holomorphic. The operator which you're taking the trace of is a trace class operator, and you get an honest-to-goodness holomorphic function. And this line here depends on the order of this expression, on the order of D in this expression. Okay. Now, when you turn this crank over here and replace D times delta to the minus S by something which looks like R times delta to the minus S, although a little bit more complicated, you get an R which has order one less. So its natural trace function is meromorphic on a slightly larger domain, like this. So the remainder is naturally meromorphic, in fact, holomorphic on a slightly larger domain. Okay, so from this formula, you see that the trace of R is the same thing as the trace of the left-hand side after you divide by this quantity here, which is going to become n plus the, so to speak, order of this operator, which is q minus rs. So up to this linear factor, the trace of d times delta to the minus s is equal to the trace of a remainder. So if you divide out by that linear factor, you might pick up a pole of order one. But you've then meromorphically continued the trace function one unit over to the left in the complex plane. And now, of course, you just repeat and you tile the whole plane with these strips. Okay, so that's essentially Gilliman's proof of this theorem. And I hope you're convinced that it's really a very basic theorem. It depends on only two things, namely tangent vectors, ddx's, and coordinates, and the natural relationship between them. So if we're using this theorem while we're constructing some sort of fancy theory, as we will, okay, it's not too bad. It's a reasonable thing to assume that one has this type of meromorphic continuation property, at least in examples which are somehow reasonably related to the classical world. Now, let me just make a little remark about a detail. I mean, you have to be a little bit careful because on the one hand, there's algebra over here, and then on the other hand, we're taking traces. I mean, this is the Hilbert space operator trace, and that involves some analysis. So at some point, you have to make sure that the analysis is talking to the algebra, and that for that, you require the following fact. So we need a relation between what you might call analytic order. I mean, rate of summability, of degrees of summability of eigenvalues, boundedness of operators on Hilbert, various Hilbert spaces, and so on. And the algebraic order of a differential operator. Which is that for every differential operator D, there should exist some constant, some little constant, not zero, which allows you to bound the L2 norm of D. In terms of just the L2 norm of U, just for insurance purposes, usually not necessary. In fact, I assumed that delta was invertible, so it's not necessary at all. And then delta to the, what am I calling these things? R is the order of delta, and Q is the order of D, so Q over R. So morally speaking, delta to the Q over R, defined by spectral theory, has order Q. So I'm saying that this order Q operator has higher strength than any other order Q operator. It's a
It's a funny requirement, perhaps, but it's familiar in PDE theory. This is precisely what's called elliptic regularity. It's exactly the condition satisfied by elliptic operators. Okay, now on to non-commutative geometry. So we've seen some basic ingredients that we'll be looking at. Spectral theory of operators, this Dieksmier trace, residues. I'll try to indicate to you why they're relevant to the idea of making a local formulation of an index formula. The various nuances on the environment in which non-commutative geometry can be carried out, but they all are more or less organized around this idea of a spectral triple. There are, as I say, there are variations on this, which is, as you probably know, three things. It's an algebra of bounded operators on a Hilbert space H, and then there's an operator D. So this is like the D of where we began, the Dirac operator. This is the D which is appeared at the very first part of this lecture. Okay. And just so I won't forget, we have lots of deltas floating around. So in this context, delta is just going to be d squared. That's just some notation. And I'll often assume for simplicity that this is an invertible operator. D is an invertible operator, just to keep my life a little bit simple. Then there are some axioms, and the major axiom is that D commuted with any element of A, I guess there are two major axioms, this is one of them, is a bounded operator. And the other major axiom is that D is not too big. Roughly speaking, you want that the resolvent of D should be a compact operator. Okay. Now, so the idea is that this is the C-infinity functions on a manifold, this is the Dirac operator on the manifold, this is the associated Laplace operator, and this is the L2 spinners. That's an example of one of these spectral triples. And we want to carry out this whole business of messing around with index theory and the Minkowski-Schneider and Pleyel theorem, formulas of Weyl and so on. And for that purpose, we have to add something just to get off the ground, and that's precisely this business here. So we're going to assume that the analog of elliptic regularity holds for this spectral triple, which is the same thing in Kahn's language as saying that the spectral triple is regular. Now there's an unfortunate conflict between my notation, for which I apologize. So this D here is supposed to be any differential operator, not necessarily the Dirac operator. On the other hand, this is a certain fixed D here. Okay, so what I'm interested in is this formula here. You know, let's just change this. For any operator at all, in a certain algebra, which I haven't told you about yet. So X should be in the algebra associated to this spectral triple. And again, you can think about what the algebra of differential operators should be once you've specified a Dirac operator and a algebra of C-infinity functions. But the sort of minimal choice is the algebra generated by A, by the commutators of D with A, which is also closed. So there are further things you have to throw in under this commutator operation, which sends x to the commutator of delta with x. So this is the minimal collection of operators we need to be in business. I mean, you could just take the algebra generated by A and D, and that would be a bigger algebra, and that would, in many cases it would be the same, and for many cases it would be adequate.
if D is the Dirac operator on a spin manifold, this thing is all differential operators, so it all works out just great in that special case. So this is not a perfect definition, because there are many interesting examples which don't fit into this context. And you don't have to venture very far from the classical world. For example, there are contact... Yeah. Oh, the algebra is... The condition of elliptic regularity is that for every x in this algebra, this estimate should hold for some epsilon. And so what I was saying is that these are sufficient conditions, but probably not necessary for what we're going to do. And in particular, there are interesting examples coming from contact manifolds which don't quite fit into this, which is kind of annoying. I mean, a contact manifold is just a manifold. Yeah. This is always true no matter what x is in the classical situation where delta is an elliptic operator. That's, as you say, the standard coercive estimate. Okay. Now I'm hypothesizing that I'm given three things, an algebra, a Hilbert space, and a D. The algebra could be anything, not necessarily commutative. The D could be anything at all, some self-adjoint operator. And these conditions are all I have to go with. Now, these conditions alone, knowing that D has compact resolvent, are not enough to guarantee this sort of estimate here. So I'm going to assume that as well. Okay, so this is a background in which you can carry out this index formula. Now, inspired by what we just saw going through Gilliman's proof of meromorphic continuation, we're going to assume to X's. This thing is meromorphic. For all X in this algebra. It too is not a consequence, just like elliptic regularity is not a consequence of the things above. Excuse me, this thing is not a consequence of elliptic regularity. And it's an interesting question, which I don't know anything about. So in the case of a manifold, we saw that this meromorphic continuation property was a simple consequence of the algebra relations in the Weyl algebra, this Heisenberg commutation relation, which is at the top left-hand board still. And I think it would be very interesting to find an algebraic condition which implies this. So something involving commutators, something involving Hochschild theory and would be very interesting, but I don't know what it might be. Okay, so this is the strange environment in which we're going to work, and perhaps you'll agree that if you just state this all at the beginning, it seems kind of bizarre, but I hope I've given you some sort of feel for why the axioms are what they are. Okay, now, I should say, by the way, I didn't really make it clear that we're tacitly assuming that this D has the same sort of supersymmetric structure as Dirac operators always have. So the problem of which this local index formula is supposed to be the solution is to compute. For a projective module over A, or if you like, an idempotent in A. To compute this thing here. This corresponds to taking the Dirac operator and twisting it with a
vector bundle and then computing the index of the Dirac operator with coefficients in that twisting bundle. Okay. This thing is, the axioms, by the way, these two axioms here tell you that this thing is a Fredholm operator, so it's kosher to take its index. And as I'm sure everyone knows, Kant's first solution of this involved the invention his invention of cyclic cohomology. So what he observed, it's a beautiful formula. Suppose F is the phase of D, or the sine of D. So you take the eigenvalues of D, lambda, and you replace the eigenvalue lambda by 1 if the eigenvalue lambda is positive, and minus 1 if the eigenvalue is negative. So you build a new operator whose eigenvalues are just plus 1 or minus 1, according to whether the eigenvalues of the original operator were plus 1 or positive or negative. Okay. Like D over the absolute value of D. So I'm just for simplicity assuming, that, as I said, that D is invertible. So what Kant discovered is, let me just do a little bit of bookkeeping here and get the constants right. So there's a yoga behind this constant, which I won't go into. If you look at this rather elaborate multilinear functional, then as long as n is sufficiently large, yeah. If I'm saying, by the way, that these things are meromorphic, if I plug in x to be the identity, in particular, I'm asserting that this guy is traceable in some half plane, so that there is some continuation possible. So I am asserting that there is a summability condition on the eigenvalues of delta for the experts. Anyway, that allows me to build something like this and be assured that the trace really does exist. Epsilon is the grading operator that we discussed earlier on. And this thing here is one of Kant's cyclic cocycles. And it has the property that if you evaluate it, stick in this idempotent in all of the entries, you do get the index that you're interested in, up to a sign. Should have put that there. Yeah, it's minus 1 to the n times n. I guess that explains most of the constant. Now, it's a beautiful algebraic formula, and of course, the machinery of cyclic cohomology is really compellingly attractive. But from a computational point of view, this formula is pretty hopeless. Because if you have a real-life operator D, for example, the Dirac operator on a manifold, and you attempt to figure out what this F is, I mean, you have to understand every single eigenvalue of this wretched Dirac operator, and you have to understand everything about the operator in order to understand what F, which is a complicated pseudo-differential operator, is. Okay, so it's not computationally very practical, despite the fact that this is just the tip of a very beautiful algebraic iceberg. Okay. So what we would like to do is to substitute this quantum integral, this Dieksmier trace, in place of the usual trace. Now, if we do that, then on the basis of what we saw back in commutative world, we would expect to obtain a formula which is closely related to an honest integral on a space, I mean, if there was a space underlying the algebra. We would also obtain a formula, I didn't really emphasize this before, which is much more computable for the following reason. This Dieksmier trace has the following obvious but nonetheless amazing property, namely that it vanishes on every operator for which this thing has a trace. So if the operator is trace class, in the ordinary sense, its Dieksmier trace is zero, which means in any complicated expression involving operators, when you want to take the Dieksmier trace, you could fiddle with all of these operators by trace class operators, and nothing happens to the Dieksmier trace.
And this, in practical examples, is an enormous simplifying factor when it comes to actually doing computations. The specific values of individual eigenvalues is no longer relevant. You only have to understand the asymptotic values, and very often that gets you somewhere very quickly. Okay. And Kant's first progress on this was his so-called Hochschild formula. Which is hard to track down in the literature because it was never proved, but it is in the book of Grazia Bondia and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the green non-commutative geometry book. Varilli, Grazia Bondia, Figuero, thank you. Okay, so what does it say? Again, let me be honest and give you the correct constants here. It's pretty much the same thing, business as usual. So it is n times n factorial, as it happens. Okay. And now, I'm going to do exactly what I said I'd like to do, namely substitute the trace and put in the Dieksmeer trace in its place. And what I'm going to take the Dieksmeer trace of is a small variation on this. If you're an expert, you'll see that this is no big deal at all. I haven't quite finished. So I've taken f's and put in d's instead. This expression a0 is the same thing as f times the commutator of f with a0 divided by 2. So there's basically no difference between those things. But we have a little bit of work to do here because this thing here is just a bounded operator according to the axioms. So it's not legal to take its Dieksmeer trace. So you have to throw in a normalizing factor like that. So suppose we have, we're in the dimension n, suppose there is a dimension n, for which this thing is Dieksmeer traceable. Okay. Suppose in fact that suppose you're looking at the smallest n for which that's true. That's the n which this theorem is referring to. In real life, in the case of an honest manifold, n is the dimension of the manifold. Okay. So the theorem is that the following, now this is not a cyclic cocycle. A cyclic cocycle has two properties. First of all, it's invariant under cyclic permutations, signed cyclic permutations. Secondly, its co-boundary under some co-boundary operation is zero. So this thing is not invariant under cyclic permutations, although it does have co-boundary zero. So it's what's called a Hochschild cocycle. And as a Hochschild cocycle, it is cohomologous. There's a slight exaggeration, although it's true in the examples we're looking at. To the one up here. So there is a map from cyclic cohomology, which is the non-commutative analog of Durand theory, to Hochschild cohomology, which loses a lot of information, okay? Typically, except in very low dimensions. But what you get once you've lost all of that information is this thing here, which is just one of these integrals. For example, in the classical case where d is a Dirac operator, this is just the integral of a0, da1, da2, up to dan by Weyl's theorem. So the top part, that's what the Hochschild class of the cyclic character is, so to speak, the top part of this cyclic Chern character is this simple differential quantity, which can be interpreted in terms of integrals on spaces in classical situations. And the question is, what about the rest? About the whole thing, check if I'm calling phi. And it took them a few years to figure this out because the way they did it was through an extraordinary act of brutality and strength. I mean, if you looked at the paper in which Kanner Moscovici actually proved the formula, when you look at the formula, you'll see that a certain element of brutality is involved. There's a lot of computation involved. Anyway, the drama takes place in a slightly different context, so let me just remind you of that, or tell you of that. there's a certain bi-complex. Goes on forever, and you could, if you wanted, continue it on this way as well. So C K is the K plus one linear functionals on A. So, for example, this thing here is an element of Cn. Okay. And then there are two differentials. The little b going upwards is the differential which makes this cyclic cocycle a cocycle. It's the Hochschild differential. This big B is related to the Durham boundary in Durham theory, and it has the property that if you have a cyclic cocycle, B of it is zero. And it also has the property that B of anything is a cyclic cochain. So, for example, if you take this cyclic fella here, okay, let's say N is 2, so I can put my finger on a point here, it would fit right here. Okay, it would be a 2 cochain. And it would a cocycle in the totalization of this complex, because little b of it is zero, and it's cyclic, so big B of it is equal to zero. Okay, so every cyclic cocycle is a cocycle in the totalization of this complex. In fact, this thing here is, the totalization of this is equivalent to the complex which computes cyclic cohomology. So instead of thinking about cyclic cocycles, you can think about BB cocycles, and it's the same thing, because every cyclic cocycle fits in to the BB complex, as I just indicated. Okay, so what they do is they construct, having Z being Kanner-Moscovich, construct a BB cocycle. Which is cohomologous. As a BB cocycle to the phi that we started with. So to construct, for example, a 2 cocycle, you need something in C2 and something in C0. To construct a P cocycle, you need something in CP, something in CP minus 2, something in CP minus 4, and da 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 da. What is it? Well, it's this horrible nightmare of a formula. Hold on to your seats. So they found this formula by brute force. The sum is a gigantic sum over multi-indices, integer-valued, non-negative and integer-valued multi-indices. And what do we have here? K plus P factorial. There's a constant CK, which I'll tell you about what it is in a moment. And then there's the residue trace, the residue at S equals zero of a certain quantity, which is the gamma function at S plus P over 2 plus K. I don't know why I'm writing this down except just to intimidate you, times the trace of epsilon A0 D A1 K1 da 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 D A N A P, excuse me, KP, and then delta, that's in terms of delta, minus P over 2 minus K minus S. Gosh, there it is. Except I didn't tell you what CK is, so that doesn't get any better. K1 factorial, K2 factorial, KP factorial, K1 plus 1, K1 plus K2 plus 2. Da 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 K1 plus da 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 plus KP plus P. Oh boy, that hurts. Well, there it is. There's one extra piece of notation, which is this business here. If I have an operator T and I raise it to an index, I mean, I take the commutator with delta, raise that to the index 1 minus, and then the P to the 0 is just T. So it's a huge formula, but you can check if P is equal to N, and if the multi-index K is the zero multi-index, then when the dust settles, what appears here is precisely what appears here. So one tiny little piece of the residue of the residue formula of Karma Moscovici is this Hochschild formula here. Okay. So this is what we're going to talk about. Let me just conclude by... Yes. These meromorphic functions which we've been talking about are all analytic in a certain right half plane, and that means that as long as P is bigger than N in the notation of these boards, then in fact phi is identically zero. So there are, despite appearances, there are only finitely many terms. The sum over multi-indices is finite, you can check, and moreover, there are only finitely many P's which actually contribute here. So you'd like to have P? Yeah. I think it's okay, because it commutes. You could put the K minus one, you could put on the T, or you could put it on the whole thing.
So I think you need that derivation.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's just half. That's just a clue about. It's not the definition. It's a clue about what the definition might be, if I was going to give it. Yeah. This is just a clue. Yeah. Okay. I just want to end with a website. This is a horrendous formula. There is a sort of rationalization behind this formula, which I could also have talked about if I didn't have to introduce the formula. So there was a second out of this talk. It would explain what this mess is all about, and you can see this discussed on my homepage. I guess this is obvious. Where I am. So there are a couple of papers. We're putting together proceedings from a conference that we actually held in 2000, so we're a little bit behind schedule. But anyway, that will be published soon, and this stuff is all discussed there. And I also gave some lectures in Trieste, which are published in some obscure place, but they're also available on the website, and they give a little more insight into this formula. Okay, I'm going to stop. Thanks.